Previously on Beta.
You know, I was never offended. It was more insulting.
China Clipper calling Alameda. Never mind that furthermore, the plea is self-defense. It is of
my opinion. It is my
opinion
that the people are intending. Very nice.
Nice. Yeah.
Larry's not with us anymore. He went on, you know. Yeah. He bit the big one.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, as we were putting this show together, we noticed that we have kind of a recurring theme, phones. Which reminds me, I should check my voicemail. Just hold on, it'll just take a minute.
Welcome to the Beta voicemail system. You have 2 new messages and 11 archived messages. To listen to your new messages, press 1.
The need for a private space to communicate has not gone away, right? And in a lot of ways, it's only become more pronounced.
Hey, that's Ariana Kelly. She wrote that book, Phone Booth. I'll call her back later.
A lot of times when people see 3 or 4 black people on the screen at once, they're gonna automatically think that this show isn't for them. And I think a lot of that went on as well.
Great, Jonathan Abrams finally got back to me. He's the guy who wrote that great oral history of The Wire, All the Pieces Matter. Later on today, we'll be talking about phone booths and tapping phones. But first, I thought I'd give Bill Hader a call. You probably remember Bill for his excellent character work on Saturday Night Live. Now Bill has a brand new show on HBO called Barry. As you might guess from the title, Bill plays Barry. Barry's a hitman from the Midwest who travels to Los Angeles to kill someone. He finds himself bitten by the acting bug when he meets his first mark at an acting class.
Hey, man. Are you new to this class?
I haven't seen you before. I'm Ryan. Ryan Madison. Listen, I was supposed to put up a scene with Matt Kennedy, but he got a catering gig. So could you help me out?
Ryan, you're up. Where's Kennedy?
He's not here. But I'm going to do the scene with him.
Bill, since we're based here in Madison, Wisconsin, I'd like to start by asking you about the person, your character, Barry, is assigned to kill in the pilot episode of Barry. His name is Ryan Madison, and he's from Madison, Wisconsin. Is there any special significance to why you had this character's last name be Madison and also double as the name of his hometown?
No, it was more of a joke of that he would take his stage name would be from where he's from. I just thought that was
funny. Yeah, and Ryan Madison sounds a lot better than Ryan Omaha, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly.
So you created Barry with Alec Berg, or as Jerry Seinfeld referred to him on Seinfeld, Alec Berg, because it's a good John Houseman name. How did you and Alec Berg come up with this premise?
I had a deal at HBO, a development deal, and then he had an overall deal at HBO, and he was doing Silicon Valley there, and so we just started chatting, you know, and just trying to figure out, you know, what a good story would be. And then we kind of hooked on, you know, the story of a hitman who decides he wants to be an actor. And the idea that the thing that you're good at is destroying you. And then the thing that you want to be good at, you know, you're not good at, you know. So it was this kind of thing that I weirdly related to in some ways, and we were like, well, that's a good emotion to kind of base the show on and then start from there and see where it goes.
Yeah, you mentioned that's something that you've related to. Is that a question, the idea that when you're good at something, it's no longer the thing you want to do, and the thing you want to do is something you're terrible at? Is that a question you've had to deal with in your own life?
Yeah, like at Saturday Night Live, I had a weird aptitude for doing voices and doing impressions and stuff, but I was not very good at live performing. It was something that scared me. I had a really bad kind of anxiety while I was there.
Yeah, would it be fair to say, would you describe that as like would you have panic attacks?
Yeah, I would have panic attacks, or I would before shows have a real bad panic. To the point where it was, I would describe it as debilitating, where I, you know, couldn't breathe or move, and just kind of, like you're having a heart attack or something.
Oh, that's not good. Yeah,
so it was hard on me, and it was a lot of stress on my body, and so I wasn't enjoying that, and I was so, I worked through it the best I could for the show, and towards the end of my time at SNL, I was having fun, but that never went away. You know, before every show, I would have a bit of a flip out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In large part, I suspect, because you just had the one shot at it, because it was live. And
yeah,
you had
to get it one right. Shot to get it right.
Yeah.
And also, I would not, you know, some things you could really practice and know, and then other things you didn't know. You mm-hmm. know, it was kind of like it got thrown together at the last minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I would get really, that was overwhelming to me. And I kind of always admired the cast of all my other cast members who were so calm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just look at them going, God, how are you so calm right now? I'm terrified.
It didn't come across on the viewing, though. Like, and as a viewer, it didn't come across
to me.
It's
so funny you say that. I watch it, and it seems to me like I'm like, can't you see how nervous I am? Look at me. You know, I'm like, how did no one notice? But yeah, you know, that's just me. You know, and you always kind of see something in yourself, at least, where you can tell or whatever.
Sure.
But no, it was very, very, to be clear, it wasn't the show's fault or whatever. It was definitely my own kind of issue that I was trying to work through. And so I, you know, it was definitely a thing that, you know, I told Alec Berg about this and kind of, you know, that emotion at least, not have a, let's not make a show about a guy who's on a live television show and has panic attacks. That's not really interesting. But a guy who kills people for a living and he's really good at it, but it's destroying his soul, I thought was interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And the other interesting thing, it is like a really strong premise. And the other interesting thing about it is this idea that the intriguing parallels there are between being an actor and being a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's this weird, you know, hitman's living in the shadows and you have to be anonymous, and you have to be kind of emotionally closed off, and acting's the exact opposite of that. You want to live in the spotlight, and, you know, you want to be known, and you want to be emotionally open.
You know how you and I talk all the time about my purpose?
You think acting could be your purpose?
I don't know. I just feel really motivated right now or something. Like, it made me feel really good.
Okay, but what about what we do together, Barry?
Well, you know, they told me a very small percentage of actors actually make a living acting, you know, so most of them have day jobs. So I just figured, you know, I do night hits or something.
Just sit.
Oh.
Okay? Now, Barry, acting is a very face-forward type of job. It's a direct conflict being someone who anonymously kills people. You want to have a hobby or something you could take up? Painting. Yeah. Hitler painted. John Wayne Gacy painted. It's a good, solid hobby. Never got in the way of what they were doing.
These are professional actors, and they're the real deal, and they say I got something.
No, I get it, but I think you got to think this thing through. I mean, you want to go out there and try to burn a guy and have him say, hey, there's the guy from the chicken commercial.
I don't know if I do commercials.
But then there are parallels, too, of, you know, as an actor, especially if you're lucky enough to work a lot, you know, you go on location, and it's a lot of sitting in airplanes and, you know, flights that get canceled, and you get routed to this, and you do, you know, and you're living out of a suitcase for a while, and it's a lot of, in shooting a TV show or a movie, usually it's a lot of boredom punctuated by short bursts of excitement, you know.
Yeah, hurry up and wait kind of thing.
Yeah, hurry up and wait, exactly.
A lot of that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's great how you have these two components that make for such a rich story. One of the things that I was surprised about watching the pilot just was how very dark the show was at times. Like, we're talking really black comedy and very existential. And I wanted to know if that's one of the challenges of the show that you enjoy, that you make these tonal shifts from light comedy to dark comedy and even dark drama.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. Yeah, I mean, to us, we're just kind of telling a story and... You know, we would talk about tone, obviously, and go, well, what's the tone of this thing?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you just kind of try it and do it and see what'll hold water and what won't hold water, you know. And you know, and some things we tried were too dark. And then some things we tried were too silly, you know. And And you cut those things to try to make the tone work. But, you know, it's like we're in a room with a bunch of really smart writers. You know, we have like 5 writers who work with us, and they're really good at kind of spotting things that, you know, it's just like if it's not emotionally or logically sound, you know, you just kind of they'll call us on it or throw it out. And then, you know, and then actors do it, and the DP does it, and the production designer does it, where they're questioning, like, you know, these things that essentially get down to tone. And then you get in the edit room, and that's really where it happens, you know, where they go, an editor will say, hey, can you look at this? We cut all this and went from this scene right to this scene, and we feel like it works pretty well. And you're like, oh, my God, you're right, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were we thinking? Why did we spend all that time shooting that thing, you know?
Yeah. You also make your directorial debut with Barry. How did you approach directing yourself? Was that tough?
Yeah, it's a bit tough. I mean, because you don't really have the, you know, what helped me was I had Alec there, to be honest, as the other showrunner, co-creator, and me, I could walk back to him and go, does that make sense? Is this feeling right, you know?
Yeah.
For the most part, I loved it. I loved the whole experience of it. It was so much fun.
Yeah, and what I was thinking was directing yourself seems kind of like a way of returning to your original career goals. Like when you first moved to Los Angeles, your goal was to be a filmmaker, and so it feels like, to me, it seems like you've come full circle.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was definitely, it was kind of a big itch I wanted to scratch where it was, you know, I'd acted a bunch and been, you know, 13 years of doing Saturday Night Live and acting,
yeah,
mostly comedies and things, and it was nice to finally, you know, do something a little different, but get a chance to direct and kind of, and in that time of working on all those comedies and everything, I learned a lot,
yeah,
you know, and so that was helpful.
Yeah, and it's nice not to have that pressure of like one take, like you have
to
get it right.
Yeah, that was the thing with SNL. It really is, just comes down to you have one take and it's on national television. I just didn't like that.
No, I could understand why you wouldn't. I was struck by how much of your acting was so purely physical in the first half of the pilot. Like, you didn't have much dialogue at all yet. You conveyed so much through your facial expressions and body language. It was really impressive, and it seemed like quite a contrast to your SNL work, where although there was physical comedy involved, you did so much verbal comedy. What do you think? Was that something you were conscious of when you were filming the pilot?
No, I mean, it's just kind of like what the character is, you know, and kind of what the story is. It wouldn't, you know, if we're writing a story about this kind of emotionally closed off, lonely guy, it you know, giving me a lot of physical stuff to do, and talking a lot wouldn't really have made sense. You wanted him to kind of open up once he gets into the acting class, you know, but he's so, you know, he's kind of just, it's more just playing the story. And I think that's, you know, a good or a bad thing about me is like I kind of just view the thing as a story we're telling. It's like you write it and you film it and you act in it and you edit it and you do all those things, but it's all just, it's about the story, you know.
Oh yeah,
what
yeah.
tells the story clearly in the most clearest place. I can't even say clear, that's funny. But yeah, you know, and just trying to figure that out, which is a real, you know, it can be really tough.
Yeah. You have a great cast, yourself, of course, and there's also Henry Winkler and Stephen Root.
Yeah, he's the best. Both guys are unreal.
Oh, yeah. As are you. Can you tell me a bit about them and them and their roles?
Well, yeah, I mean, Henry, you know, he was kind of the guy that we were kind of thinking of at the time, and then he came in and read, and he auditioned, and we were so nervous that when he came in and read, and then he was just phenomenal.
We're all still very raw, so I say class dismissed. Go home, and I encourage you to journal all of your emotion, all of your feelings. But even though we're not acting, we're still learning to act. This class counts. Stepping away from the class is in itself a lesson. So that there are no rain checks, is my point. Okay, everyone pays full boat for today.
And then, you know, same with Stephen Root. Both these guys auditioned, which I was so play by, and they came in an audition, and they were just phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. Root's amazing. Like, he's a not to take anything away from Henry. Henry's amazing too, but Root is like such a chameleon in so many different times.
I mean,
such a different person.
These guys are both just such wonderful actors.
Yeah. Yeah, I read this great quote from Henry Winkler in an interview. He said that working on Barry is like putting on a cashmere sweater that's on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I
like
can't
put on a cashmere sweater instead of a cotton blend or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't blame him. That's a great line. So, is that what Barry, what working on Barry feels like to you?
You know, it was kind of as a showrunner, whatever, co-showrunner, co-creator, and all that stuff. It's like me and Alec are constantly, it's like, you know, it's like you're throwing a party, so you're having a good time, and you're hoping other people are having a good time, but you're constantly keeping an eye on, you know, is the food there, is no one's wrecking that thing, is it, you know what I mean? You're,
yeah,
you're like,
yeah,
you're there, but you're also someplace else. You know, you're having fun, but you also have you're also split between having fun and the responsibility of the thing.
Yeah. One last thing, Bill. Are you loving the writing, directing, and acting, doing all these three major duties of Barry? Are you loving those as much as Barry loves acting?
I do love it, yeah. I mean, writing is probably the hardest because you're starting with nothing and trying to, you know, build something from it, so it does feel like you're just staring at a wall and you're trying to make it move, right?
Yeah,
staring at it.
Right.
But it, you know, it is a lot of fun, and it is, especially with a group of people that you like, you know, I think I love that aspect of it. And then directing I love because I just like working with the actors, and I love working with the director of photography and the production designer and the costume designer and hair and makeup and all those people and those departments. It's a lot of fun to create with those things, but it all starts with the script, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It has to it's what I've learned over the years, man, just doing this, is like it all can be traced back to the script. As long as the script's good, you can even make a mediocre movie. A bad director can make a pretty good movie with a good script.
Now look, you're in a shell. You need to break out. And I've got the perfect antidote for you. 10 cc's of pure Mammoth.
Mammoth?
Yeah. You're gonna play Blake in Glengarry Glen Ross, the movie. I'm gonna send you the pages. Here's my only direction. Let the cat out.
Bill Hader is the co-creator, co-executive producer, and star of the HBO series Barry.
You see what happened a couple years ago with the sad death of Freddie Gray, and it's almost like The Wire is going to be relevant until some of these issues and challenges that we face as a society are addressed accurately. That's why I think The Wire is still as relevant today as it was back when it was on the air.
In a minute, we explore the history of one of the greatest TV series of all time, The Wire. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yo.
What up, man?
Yo, Stink, what up?
Yo, where your manners, fool?
Oh, my bad, yeah.
Let's catch us tomorrow, man.
All right. Yeah. All right, later.
Non-pertinent. How do you log that non-pertinent?
No drug talk?
They use codes to hide their patron phone numbers. And when someone does use a phone, they don't use names. And if someone does use a name, he's reminded not to. All of that is valuable evidence.
Of what?
Conspiracy.
Conspiracy?
We're building something here, Detective. We're building it from scratch. All the pieces matter.
The Wire is now considered to be one of the best shows in television history, but it was pretty under the radar when it debuted in 2002. The show's become more popular and more relevant since it went off the air 10 years ago. The Wire tackled many of the issues that are now a huge part of our national conversation. For example, the failures of both the drug war and the criminal justice system. The show also predicted the decline and fall of the newspaper industry. Jonathan Abrams joins us to discuss his new oral history of the show, All the Pieces Matter, the inside story of The Wire.
the very first thing that I saw was that I had never seen a show with this many multidimensional African-American characters. So that's what really stuck out to me, to where I had never seen that type of diversity on the screen before. And in talking with David Simon, the creator, he was saying that he wasn't trying to make a quote-unquote black show, but he was trying to show the accurate reflections for the Baltimore that he knew.
So you talk about The Wire's lack of recognition, and by the time the final season aired, a lot of TV critics had declared how great a show it was, but Emmy voters didn't give it much love. The Wire received, what, only 2 Emmy nominations for writing over the course of its 5 seasons, and it didn't win either of those awards that it was nominated for. Why do you think The Wire didn't get as much recognition and acclaim as it deserved?
I think one of the big reasons was that The Wire was never associated with Hollywood, right? It was obviously produced and shot in Baltimore by people who resided in Baltimore and were from Baltimore. So it didn't have much of a association with the award ceremonies or anything like that. And then, you know, another thing was that it was a lot of black people on the screen. And I think people didn't necessarily appreciate or recognize it in that manner. Andre Royo, who played Bubbles, in his interview for the book, one of the things that he said that stuck out for me was that a lot of times when people see 3 or 4 black people on the screen at once, they're going to automatically think that this show isn't for them. And I think a lot of that went on as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David Simon created The Wire, and he originally envisioned the show as a novel. Do you think that Simon's ambitious vision of the show was maybe another reason why it didn't get many viewers when it started airing in 2002?
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine being one of the few people who watched that first season, and you're dropped into this dense universe. There's so many characters coming at you. They're talking with their Baltimore drawl, and you can only get every other word. And then it's over for a week, right?
Yeah.
No streaming. There's no DVD. You can't see the next episode. And it asked a lot of you to be able to carry that on week to week. So that's why it benefited so much when DVDs and streaming came out and people could digest it in one setting, because it is like a book.
I mean,
you can only really appreciate it by its whole.
Yeah, it's very dense, especially the pilot, the very first episode. You're introduced to so many characters. It's like you almost have to watch it a couple of times or 3 times to get sort of hooked into that world properly. In the show Bible that David Simon submitted to HBO when he was trying to get the green light to produce The Wire, he said that the grand theme is nothing less than a national existentialism. And that sounds like a pretty novelistic description to me. What did David Simon tell you about his vision of The Wire and what would make it different from other TV shows?
I think he envisioned it as a way to reach the masses with his arguments. He had already written a couple nonfiction books, and the audience that's going to read a book is only so large. So many more people watch television. So I think he began by writing on homicide, and that was his introduction into television writing, because he had written the nonfiction book for that, and then NBC ended up buying it. And I don't think he originally appreciated television. A lot of the stuff that he wrote for his first episode in Homicide got written out, and it took a while for him to really realize that was a worthy medium. And I think in real time he realized he was trying to do something that hadn't ever been done before.
Yeah. Maybe one of the reasons The Wire felt like a novel on TV was because its writing staff included these great crime novelists, people like Richard Price and George Pelicanos. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my favorite things about reporting this book, was talking to all these really, really renowned novelists. And Dennis Lehane, who wrote Mystic River, is another one of them.
Yes.
And when you're writing a book, it's so isolating. It's just oftentimes you and your editor, and you're not getting feedback from the outside world until you put the finished product out. So for these guys, they really had to put their ego aside and argue and be willing to let others' ideas carry the day for them to get any work done. I mean, it's sometimes, in talking to David Simon and his co-creator Ed Burns, it was a wonder to me that they got any work done, because it just seemed that they argued so much.
Yeah, and that reminds me, that makes me think of one of my favorite David Simon quotes that he would often use with when he was arguing with somebody, which from my understanding was quite often.
Let me guess, and I think I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, which one?
I could agree with you, but then we'd both be wrong.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, that's a great line. That's great. Great. I wonder, I bet debate teams in high school are using that now, probably, because that's just a great line. Yeah. So one of the most fascinating things about The Wire is that almost all, if not all, of the writers were white, yet here they are writing a black story, writing this dialogue for black actors. How are they able to pull this off so effectively?
So I think a lot of the actors realized and recognized that that their heart was in the right place, and that they had, you know, David Simon had been a homicide journalist for a long time at the Baltimore Sun, and Ed Burns had won a lot of respect by working in the Baltimore Homicide Department as a detective. So I think they earned the actors' trust. And then one of the biggest things that I'm sure we'll get into later is that David Simon and Ed Burns pivoted so fully in season two to show that the drug issues is not necessarily a race problem, but a class problem. Mm-hmm. And I think in real time, a lot of the actors from season one were really furious that their screen time was being diminished, but they came to appreciate what David Simon and Ed Burns were trying to tell by shifting so fully.
Many people, including the former President Barack Obama, say that Omar Little was their favorite character. Can you tell me a bit about Omar and the actor who portrayed him?
Yeah, so Omar was a character who, he had a code, but inside his code, his whole world was robbing drug dealers.
Everybody want to believe the worst about Omar. I mean, there are some rules here, right?
Rules?
Yeah. No mistakes, no bystanders, no taxpayers getting caught up in the mix. But the game is out there, and it's either play or get played.
I mean, I had never seen a character like that. I doubt that I ever will again, where he doesn't curse, he's gay. We had never really seen a black gay guy on TV like mm-hmm. that. It was actually the actor, Michael K. Williams, it was his idea to have a kiss on screen with his lover that first season, which was something that definitely surprised the director at the time. But he was a character who gained in myth as the show continued on. One of the funnier things was that George Pelicano said that people argued that during the fifth season, when Omar jumps out of an apartment building, that people complained that The Wire finally jumped the shark when he survived this jumping out of the building. But in real life, the figure that they based it on jumped off of a building window from like two floors higher.
I would imagine that for some of the actors, portraying characters who are dealing with these harsh lifestyles and living in these emotionally volatile headspaces, that must have been very challenging for them. How did they deal with it?
Yeah, especially somebody like Andre Royo, who had to basically tear himself up. I think it stayed with them for a while after the show, and it was a little bit hard to shake off. And even coming back to season five, I remember Andre Royo talking about, now that Bubbles is clean, he was like, how can I go from here? Because I've been in this crazy headspace the last few years trying to tear myself down to portray this guy and his addiction. And now all of a sudden I'm the person's clean. How do how do I deal with that?
I didn't get high. Huh? See? I knew if I did, I wouldn't get that good feeling back that I was daydreaming.
That's right. That's
right. Got me thinking about a friend of mine. Boy named Sherrod. Been carrying his passing for a long while. Ain't no shame in holding on to grief. As long as you make room for other things too.
It's all right. It's
okay. So thank you for listening. Thank you for letting me share.
David Simon often said that the city of Baltimore was itself a character in The Wire, and Andre Royo, who portrayed Reginald Bubbles' cousins, told you that Baltimore was the best character in the show. When people would ask him who's the best character in the show, he would say, Baltimore. And David Simon often used local actors and crew members. How did Baltimore officials feel about The Wire being filmed in their backyard?
I think it's a little bit of a mixed legacy. Martin O'Malley was the mayor at the time, and he subsequently became governor, and the character of Tommy Carchetti was somewhat based off of him, at least partially And I think at one moment, Martin O'Malley claimed that he was going to be the antidote to The Wire. The thing that I enjoy about The Wire is I think it could have been located in Los Angeles or New York. I think the problems that David Simon was trying to show are universal throughout our country. So I think it could have worked in other cities. But the fact that it was Baltimore, and Baltimore's so closely, eternally related to the show, I think is a bit of a mixed blessing.
Yeah. Didn't the commissioner of Baltimore, Frederick H. Bielfeld III, he really said something like very derogatory about them filming it, the effect of The Wire filming in Baltimore?
Yeah, I think he compared it to other shows with their dashing attorneys and their scenic views. But I think anybody who tries to bring up those type of arguments are missing the real impact and influence on the show.
Clearly, yeah. Has The Wire had an impact on the real world in the sense of changing the kinds of conversations that politicians, professors have when they talk about critical social issues?
I mean, it's something that's definitely discussed and talked about politically or studied critically in classes, but I think that's one of the issues that David Simon still has about the show, is that the arguments he was trying to present are not studied as they should be or taken into account as they should be. If you look around right now, we're still debating the war on drugs, or you see what happened a couple years ago with the sad death of Freddie Gray, and it's almost like The Wire is going to be relevant until some of these issues and challenges that we face as a society are addressed accurately. That's why I think The Wire is still as relevant today as it was back when it was on the air.
After Gray's death, there was rioting and looting on the same streets where The Wire was filmed. Did any of the people involved in The Wire have anything to say about this?
Yeah, I mean, some of the actors felt like The Wire had predicted such a situation happening by how they portrayed the kids being taken into the wagons and given rough rides. Basically, they thought that The Wire was almost predicting the future.
Some motherfuckers just standing somewhere? Yo, we America! West Baltimore.
The title of your book, All the Pieces Matter, comes from an episode from the first season, and it seems that that phrase applies to why the show is considered by many to be the best TV series of all time. All of the pieces, the writing, the directing, the acting, and everything else were at the highest level and combined to make something that's greater than its individual pieces. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely agree. In season one, you see a tiny character like Stan Velchek be introduced maybe once or twice. And then by the second season, you see his role start to grow. And then by the end of the series, he becomes a police commissioner. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing how David Simon weaved this all together and had a plan from the get-go about where these characters are going. Even if we as a viewer just saw this character quickly and dismissed him, David Simon had a plan for him.
Yeah. The actor Robert Wisdom, who played Howard Bunny Colvin, told you something interesting about there being two kinds of people in the world. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. He said people who have seen The Wire and people who haven't seen The Wire.
Yeah. Can you make the case for why those people who haven't watched The Wire should watch it?
Yeah. I mean, it explains why things are the way that they are and how the institutions that we have a lot of faith in, how they oftentimes don't accommodate the individual or aren't set up to accommodate the individual.
That's Jonathan Abrams. He's the author of All the Pieces Matter, The Inside Story of The Wire. For more information, visit WPR.org/beta. And we'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to beta@WPR.org.
I'm in a glass case of emotion!
We explore the history of these glass cases of emotion right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you remember the last time you used a phone booth? Do you even remember the last time you saw a phone booth? It's been a while, hasn't it? It's safe to say that the phone booth is on the verge of obsolescence. Nobody knows this better than Ariana Kelly. She's the author of a book called Phone Booth. In the book, Kelly explores the cultural history of the phone booth, and she talks about what we've lost with the disappearance of these unique spaces. We decided to talk to her, and we figured that, in the interest of authenticity, the best way to talk to Ariana would be to call her from, you got it, a phone booth. There was only one problem. Where were we going to find a phone booth? Well, we reached out to you fans, and you beta fans, or alphas as we call you, came through for us. You helped us find one on the west side of town. So the beta team packed up our equipment, and we headed over to one of Madison's few remaining phone booths. And we called Ariana Kelly to find out more.
Hello?
Hi, Ariana. How are you? It's Doug Gordon calling from one of the few remaining phone booths here in Madison, Wisconsin. Do you have a few minutes to talk?
Yes, I do. I'd love to talk.
Okay, great. Your book about phone booths, which appropriately enough is called Phone Booth, is fascinating. So I'm curious, why did you want to write a book about phone booths?
Well, the impetus actually came from a group called Beta Level, who at the time ran a nonfiction monthly reading series. Each month it was kind of focused around a theme, and there was one particular month where the theme was obsolescence, and someone happened to mention this to me, and I heard the word and I immediately thought of phone booths. There was actually no gap in my thinking, it just immediately came to mind. I thought of it because when I was in college in the late 90s, there was a period of time in which I only made telephone calls from this one particular phone booth in New Haven. That's the only place I could really bring myself to have any sort of communication with people. That continued when I moved to Ireland, and there was this one particular phone booth across the street from where I worked. And again, it was just the only place I could really have concerted, significant conversations was from this phone booth, this one being in Ireland. And it really, I never really thought about it after that phase passed. It just kind of lived in my memory. And then, but obviously it was incredibly significant in some way. And so then when that kind of opportunity came along, I thought of the phone booth, and I just thought it'd be something that would be really interesting to explore, because given how ubiquitous mobile phones have become in our life, and I was really kind of a latecomer to cell phones, and particularly iPhones and mobile devices. And so it just became kind of an excuse to, I wrote an essay that explored kind of the cultural history of phone booths, and then an opportunity came along for me to expand it into a book, which I did.
Can you talk about those two experiences, what it was like using those phone booths, why that was your main source of communication with other people?
That was just a seminal time in my life. It was a time of transition. I was graduating from college, and then when I was using the phone booth in New Haven, and then when I was living in Ireland, that was kind of my first year away from school, out in college, sort of out in the larger world. And I know that when I was using this particular phone booth in New Haven, those calls occurred after a long period of isolation, community and psychological isolation. And it was just very difficult for me to communicate, I think, in a real, significant, or even very honest way. Mm-hmm. And there are various reasons for that, I think. Maybe part of the impetus for the phone booth is that in my last year, I shared an apartment with three of my closest friends, and so there was a dearth of privacy, and there happened to be a dearth of privacy right at the moment in my life when I was really feeling like I wanted to reach out into the world. So there was this phone booth down the street that I found, and I made the first phone call, and it was kind of this unleashing of all this stuff that I hadn't been saying, I think, for years. So I just continued to go back to that particular place. I think I treated it as, in some ways, as a confessional, and there was something about the particular dimensions of the space and the fact that it was a relatively private space in public that created this kind of emotional space where I felt like I was able to express myself without fear of repercussion in some way. It was a place where I could be honest and not worry about being punished, because I was speaking in a different kind of space. I mean, it was a dirty, ramshackle space, and yet in some way it felt sacred. It was sacred to the extent that I could communicate more profoundly than I'd been able to do in a long time.
Yeah. The most famous telephone booth has got to be the one that Doctor Who uses, the TARDIS.
It's a lot to take in, isn't it? Tiny box, huge room inside. What's that about? Let me explain.
It's another dimension.
It's basically another dimension. What?
I've been reading up on all the latest scientific theories. Parallel universes.
I like the bit when someone says it's bigger on the inside.
Can you tell me about it and the role it plays in the history, the cultural history of phone booths?
Yeah, the TARDIS is not kind of a traditional phone booth. It's a police box is designed for policemen to be able to make phone calls to the station or kind of record information about what happened. But the fact that that ends up being the Doctor's time travel machine seems really significant in the sense that, and this is not original to me, I've read this, but this idea that he was kind of a policer of worlds, essentially, mm-hmm. and that he's trying essentially to kind of make peace within whatever world he's in and sort of make peace sort of between and among the different time periods he travels through. And so the British telephone box became the sort of oddly appropriate symbol of his job, essentially, or the function he was trying to perform for the world.
Yeah, it seems to me that the TARDIS might have even more cultural significance to us these days, since we would need a TARDIS to go back in time to a period when phone booths were still popular.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. The funniest description of a phone booth is probably made by Ron Burgundy, played by Will Ferrell in the 2004 film Anchorman.
Ron, where are you?
I'm in a glass case of emotion!
One of the most horrifying phone booth scenes in film history occurs in Alfred Hitchcock's 1963 horror film, The Birds. Kind of comes across like a cautionary tale about why you shouldn't ever use a phone booth. The scene in which Tippi Hedren's character Melanie Daniels is in the phone booth and she's being attacked, the seagulls are attacking, breaking the glass as she's in there. What's your take on this scene?
Well, that's absolutely one of my favorite phone booth films,
to
be sure. I think it's really interesting because she doesn't actually need to go into the phone booth to make a call. I mean, she's relatively safe within the diner, and there is a telephone there.
Yeah.
So it's very curious that she actually goes outside and goes into the phone booth. And for me, I just think it ends up being this incredible visual because you see her kind of contorted and twisting and sort of totally under siege.
Yes.
And of course, she's under siege from the birds, but she's also being attacked by internal demons and demons that are kind of actually sort of much harder to see. And I think when you see her, that image of her contorted and twisting and in panic in the phone booth serve a perfect representation of what's actually happening for her inside her head.
You talk about this short Spanish film from 1972 called La Cabina, and I was really fascinated to read about this film. Can you tell me about it?
It's a short film, and it's such a kind of a visual stunt. This Italian guy drops his son off at school, and then he steps into a phone booth, and the door closes behind him, and he can't open it. It's a glass phone booth, so he's perfectly visible to everyone around him. He's going through all these different contortions to try and get out of the phone booth, and he can't. And so, you know, he becomes the sort of the subject, not of empathy, but of ridicule by everyone who's watching him.
Yeah, they're kind of laughing and making fun of him and things, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It does not inspire any sympathy whatsoever, and really nobody tries to help him. And at the end of the film, which is not a very long film, you see this area where all these other people have been sort of caught in the same situation with this particular phone booth, and you see their kind of desiccated skeletons. It's a very odd film that seems like an allegory in some way for the human condition. It does not present us in a very favorable
way. No, exactly. And that ending reminds me of the Monty Python Milkman sketch, the one in which Michael Palin plays a milkman and then Carol Cleveland, wearing a negligee, leads him up the stairs, seduces him, and then she locks him in a room filled with a whole bunch of milkmen, including a skeleton and some really old milkmen. Are you familiar with that sketch?
That's funny. You know what? I have not thought about it in years, but I am. That's an interesting connection.
Yeah. One of the most interesting phone booths is the Mojave phone booth. As you say, mm-hmm. it's one of the first internet memes before the idea of memes even existed. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah. This is a phone booth that was erected in the 1960s in the middle of the Mojave for volcanic cinder miners in the area. And it's a very desolate area. It's very sparsely populated. It appeared as sort of a telephone, just like a lonely little telephone icon on a map. This image of a telephone out in the middle of the Mojave Desert inspired this guy to go out there and visit it, simply because he was really intrigued by the idea of something being in the middle of so much nothing. Not that the desert is nothing, but just kind of, you know, sort of
uninhabited by society. And so he went out there, and then he ended up writing an account of it for a small magazine. And this guy, Godfrey Daniels, whom I actually met, read it, and he became really fascinated by it. So he decided to make a pilgrimage out there and became so enamored of this sort of single piece of sort of human existence out in the middle of this vast desert that he ended up making a website devoted to it, ironically enough. It was sort of a labor of love and kind of an artistic project. He'd never really expected, at least initially, to garner any attention. And then all of a sudden, he started getting all these messages from people who had come across it and who had then were inspired to make their own pilgrimages out to this phone booth in the desert. As the years went on, people would just go out there and camp out there and wait to answer. The number got out, and people would call it, and people would answer the phone and have conversations, sort of random conversations with these strangers who were calling from across the country and around the world. And it developed this real kind of cult following, and it sort of became this place where people could make these unexpected connections, could have these kind of unexpected conversations, and sort of communicate in a different kind of way than they would in their normal life.
Yeah, you describe the thousands of visitors as devotees, as zealous, as adherents of any religious sect. And I found that description very interesting, because you compare the phone booth to a confessional box, and also so many people's nowadays, quote unquote, worship their cell phones. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a connection. I loved the idea of the Mojave phone booth and the stories surrounding it, just because they seemed very poignant to me. And
yes,
it seemed like people were coming to this object that had been inscribed with this particular type of significance just by virtue of other people finding it valuable and reaching out of their normal, kind of the orbits of their normal lives to either go to it and just sort of be near it, or to make a phone call to it, or to answer calls that came to it. And there just seemed to be something quite spiritual about that, in the sense that it was sort of this sort of a reaching out, kind of a trying to transcend normal boundaries and create connections that were kind of inherently meaningful just by virtue that they were connecting with somebody that they hadn't connected before. And I just thought that really kind of spoke to the idea of prayer, and how prayer is often kind of described as being a call to the divine, sort of a call out of our normal existence to something else, you know, either in praise or kind of in pursuit of help. And there just seemed to be something so beautiful about these people making these voyages, and even, you know, simply calling the number from the comfort of their own home with the hope, or just kind of the sort of waiting to see whether someone else would pick up.
Mojave Desert. This is it. Fine, thanks.
Do you think phone books could ever make a comeback like vinyl records have? You know, what's old comes back again? Any chance that could happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways they actually are, sort of, you know, sometimes literally, but often a little bit more metaphorically. So, and one thing I wrote about that I thought was really interesting is that in the Amish and Mennonite communities, they're actually, which obviously they have a very kind of tenuous relationship with technology, and they're very wary of it.
Yes.
And at the same time, a lot of those communities know that they need to have maintained some sort of connection with the technological world. And so some of those communities are going out of their way to sort of rebuild phone booths, so that they give people these places to talk, but the idea is that it isolates communication and hopefully kind of tempers the effect that it has on the world outside of the phone booth, and sort of helps people maintain their focus on what's really important as opposed to constantly trying to be connected. I know that in, you know, places like Facebook campuses, there are actually booths where there are no actual phones in them, but they are booths where you can go with your cell phone, you know, or even your computer.
Oh, interesting. And kind of recreate the feeling of being in a phone booth. That's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, the need for a private space to communicate has not gone away, right? And in a lot of ways, it's only become more pronounced.
Yes.
A lot of times you give people the space, and now we carry our phones with us, but at least we have the space to kind of exit the kind of the normal flow of things and sort of go into a different kind of space to have these conversations. A lot of them also are kind of Wi-Fi hotspots, so if you're not going to talk on the phone, you can check your email and communicate in a different kind of way. I think the idea is very much alive, and I think people are ever more aware of the need to kind of regulate their relationship with technology and to sort of potentially isolate themselves from kind of the comma flow of people around them. And then I also just think that we create kind of our own booths in the sense of the absorption with which we look at our phones now is effectively kind of like a psychological booth that we erect around ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, that's very well said. Thanks so much, Arianna. It was great talking to you. Bye.
Bye.
Arianna Kelly is the author of Phone Booth. We called her from one of the few remaining phone booths on Earth. That's it for this edition of Beta. Let us know what you think. Send your thoughts in an email to beta@wpr.org. We welcome all comments, good, bad, or ugly. I have no feelings left to hurt. And you can become an alpha, that's what we call our beta fans, and give us a follow on Twitter. Our handle is @WPRBeta. Beta is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Beat Productions. Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
That name sounds like royalty. Are you royalty?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I am hard, but I am fair.
And special thanks to you, our alphas. And until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You think you're Mickey Spillane? You think you're some kind of writer?